Today on Rockin' the Suburbs,
we talk to musicians for whom today is tomorrow.
Oh no, man. I'm not getting in an any time machine.
Okay, Patrick, so we have another interview, another musician band interview.
Yeah.
This week on Rockin' the Suburbs. I'm Jim Linehan.
And I'm Patrick Foster.
This, of course, was also done via Zoom. Yep. And you'll hear why, not only because of pandemic, but also just geography. They're like on the other side of the earth. We talked, yeah. Right?
Yeah.
But this particular interview is with members of the Beths.
Yes.
And we'll let Nick here set it up for us, who they are and what they do, because the interview was actually set up by listener Nick Scalera, listener and patron of the podcast, Nick Scalera. Welcome, Nick.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you, Nick.
Obviously, it's like, I was pretty thrilled about this.
Yes. Yeah. So how did this happen, Nick?
Essentially, every once in a while, I'm always like telling my daughter, like, you know, you won't get if you don't ask, you know. And so
right.
I was just kind of flipping through Twitter, and, you know, I've been a big fan of the Beths since, you know, the day they sort of, you know, got into my consciousness, which is right. Like, I guess, 2 summers ago.
Mm-hmm.
And just, you know, kind of, I had, you know, sort of noticed who their management company was on Twitter. And I'm like, oh, just send them a DM on Twitter and see if they'd be interested. I say, I know these guys. They have this great podcast called Rockin' the Suburbs. And I said, do you think the Beths would be interested in doing an interview about their new album? I actually sent them a link to all the times the Beths had been mentioned
yeah.
on Rockin' the Suburbs.
And a few times.
You know, it's on there. So that might have helped. But I wasn't expecting an answer at all, frankly. But pretty soon after, I got a message back from their management company, and they put us in touch with the publicist. And then within like a week, we were doing this thing. So it was I was thrilled that it went off. I wasn't sure it was going to happen, but it was really great to do.
I just love the idea that you as a listener are like programming the show you want to hear.
More,
I think that's
please.
Great. Yeah,
it's like choose your own adventure.
That's right.
Yeah.
Well, Jim, I'll never forget the day on our show when we were sitting on the deck and Nick was out there at your place, and it was the first time he brought the Beths to our attention, because it was kind of like, one of those things where what he'd been listening to lately, and he brought up the Beths, and that was really great. That's when it kind of exploded for all of us, and I think a lot of people in our community have become big fans of the band.
Oh, for sure. Okay, so for people who aren't familiar, Nick, who did we talk to, and how would you describe their sound, or how did you get into them?
The Beths are a band from Auckland, New Zealand. We talked to Elizabeth Stokes, who's the lead singer, main songwriter, and Jonathan Pierce, who is the guitarist, and he's also the producer of their recordings. They started a few years back. They are, you know, guitar-based indie pop. They are masterful at writing just really catchy pop hooks. But their songs are also, the lyrics are very clever, kind of self-deprecating, very interesting to listen to. But I mean, I think what'll come out in the interview is weird. It's just like, they are really serious about their craft. They work really hard to write really tight songs that have just a structure that really anyone could kind of key into. The choruses and the verses are often unexpected, but they're always great. They have fantastic vocal harmonies. Jonathan can really shred a guitar solo. I mean, they're an interesting combination of different aspects. It's a really tight band. I've seen them live a couple of times. Some of the other Rockin' the Suburbs fans actually got together and saw them back in D.C. a while ago. at Songbird, now closed, and hopefully back someday soon.
Yeah.
But they're a great live band. They're a lot of fun. They are able to reproduce their sound pretty flawlessly on stage, which isn't always something that can happen, especially those vocal harmonies. So, yeah, I think it's a really fun band. I think that they are in the sort of New Zealand tradition a lot. There are influences from Flying Nun and other indie bands in New Zealand that we'll kind of talk about a little bit later. But I really think just knowing kind of a lot of our fans of the podcast, for those who haven't heard them, I think they're kind of instantly catchy. And if you start with their first album, Future Me Hates Me, just the first track will jump right out at you. So highly recommended. And then you'll get to hear them talk about their music, and they're extremely articulate and intelligent, and they put a ton of work and thought into this music, and it's pretty obvious in the product.
All right. That's a great setup. That's better than we can do, Patrick. So,
without a doubt.
So here we go. We have two parts to this interview. You're going to hear part one today and then part two tomorrow. You guys ready to roll tape?
Let's do it.
All right, here we go. Elizabeth and John, welcome to our podcast. Where are you guys right now?
We're in Auckland, New Zealand. It's a cloudy day. It's basically winter, coming midwinter. Yeah.
I just watered our plants.
They're a bit sad.
I think we had some people around a couple of days ago. I think they took a swipe somehow.
Hmm. Yeah.
But I'm hoping the basil kind of sorts itself out again in a minute.
Yeah, Jonathan propagated a lot of basil during our lockdown period, which was back in April.
So I want to ask about that. Let me start with that, and then these guys can ask the music nerd questions. I want to ask, you guys in New Zealand have done a great job with, you know, containing and mitigating the pandemic, right? So the virus there. So what could you tell us? Because we've done, you know, a not so good job here in the United States.
Oh, you tried. we got lucky in a lot of ways, and we can see that just that, like, if we'd gotten cases earlier, we would have been in a worse position. But we had a full lockdown for 4 weeks in April.
We like everyone stayed at home. There really was no one on the street.
It was just supermarkets were allowed to open, so no restaurants, no. But we were able to do that because the government released a huge wage subsidy. So everybody, if your income took a 30% knock, you were eligible for this subsidy that was like $580 a week or something like that.
Wow.
So that's how, for instance, all of us made it through. And then it's kind of extended a little bit once we got down to zero cases. Things started opening back up again, and currently we're still at zero cases in the community, zero cases in the country. But there's like maybe 25 or 30 cases, but they're all in quarantine at the border. So people who've come back from overseas. So there's always stuff in the news about trying to keep those borders really tight, but within the community, things have kind of gone back to some kind of normal, except with no tourism.
So are you able to play shows there?
We played an album release show on Saturday night.
Yeah, I was going to ask how that was. I mean, was it weird after the lockdown period, or how were people acting in the audience? Yeah. I guess
I think the silver lining of the lockdown period is that people are very keen to get out and support and have a good time and stuff now that they can.
Now they can safely, yeah.
And so, yeah, I mean, I guess I wish that for everyone who manages to kind of successfully, safely reinstate those sorts of things, because it's really great, like, the, you know, the amount of support, even for small shows right up to really big shows, and we sit somewhere in the middle, and we've just really felt the love going back into playing shows.
Yeah, I think because we were not sure if maybe people will be a lot more anxious or something about what that was going to be like. But it seems like, yeah, once it was safe, everybody was out. Like the
And that didn't take much encouragement, you know. It was like nervous for a couple of weeks, and then people realized, like, oh, like, this is awesome again. Let's make it awesome.
Yeah.
Yes, we're looking forward to that day.
Yeah, I look forward to it for you guys too.
2025, we'll get there.
Yeah, let's aim for maybe like January 2022.
That works. Sounds better.
That'll work for us. We can be there.
But all right. What does this mean for your release, though? Because yes, you can play shows in New Zealand, and maybe, I don't know, where else can you play right now? Does this really impact your plans for promoting the record?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Hugely.
Yeah, like, yeah.
We can, you know, we think of ourselves as a touring band. So, I mean, we normally would have already done kind of like a big tour of the States and of Europe and Australia and New Zealand, and be looking at going back and continuing for the rest of the year up until next year. So like all of that was kind of in the works and is now scrapped. So I don't know. We're now that the album's out, because there's been a big flurry of activity, like pushing towards the album release, like you're getting everything done, getting everything out. And now it's just out, and it's like, oh, now we kind of can actually feel the difference, because now is when we would be playing it to people and busy and distracted and all that kind of stuff. And now we're just like kind of waiting.
Yeah. There's always a little bit of a come down after you manage to put something out, or like manage to kind of get over a big hurdle, like what this weekend has kind of been for us in terms of just a massive build up to that show and to releasing the album. Well, it's been a few weeks doing that, and then there's always a bit of a come down, but the come down would have been dampened by being able to then see a runway of, you know, 150 shows in front of you.
Yeah.
With the horizon as it is now, it's the come down is feeling pretty hard.
And talk a little bit more, if you wouldn't mind, Elizabeth, about the fact of what is it in your mind to be a touring band? You know, what does that involve?
I mean, for us, it's a big part of it is just the fact that we, as musicians, like the four of us, we really like to play music, like, that sounds stupid, but like, I mean, we've talked to musicians before who kind of maybe self-actualize as like writing or as like making music. And that's the most fun part. And that, mm-hmm. that kind of like the craft and the creation of it. And I really like that as well. But like a big, huge part of it for the four of us is actually physically playing together, playing songs together, getting really good at the songs over the course of playing a bunch of shows, kind of like feeling those small improvements, and of course like connecting with people at the shows and like talking to them afterwards and like trying to get a really good energy going in the room and all that stuff. For us as a band, it's a big part of why we enjoy doing it and like why we tour so much. And it's also like touring is also how you generally make money as a band now in the streaming music world. So it's like for us as a band, it's a big part of music. So not having it just means it's just different. So you still have the creating part and we are still able to play together now, which is lucky. And we will be able to play in New Zealand, which is a huge thing and something we're really grateful for, but just,
Yeah, totally. And we've interviewed some bands, right, Jim, during this lockdown who are like, we're just not the same band if we're not sitting around in the same room with the instruments turned up and, you know, we got some beers and we're like, this is how we, you know, make our thing happen. So it's interesting to hear that, too, from the touring perspective, especially talking to fans, right? That's got to be a massive part of it.
Yeah, there's something that just, like, if there's something about an audience to just validate doing the thing.
Yeah, you know? Totally. Like,
and an internet audience is still an audience, and we're still very, you know, grateful and respectful to those people, but like, it's not, it's just not the same level of instant validation.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah,
you know,
yeah, we do it for the claps, and if we can't get those claps,
I know.
I've noticed that with other artists and things, like when you watch them doing these like live streams from their home, they'll finish a song and they sort of, there's like this awkward moment where they don't quite know what to do because they're used to getting, you know, applause and feedback, and that sort of fills that space, right. And suddenly it's not there, right?
I mean, it is feedback in a weird way. You kind of tune yourself into the nuances of what an audience reacts, and testing new songs, you know.
Yeah, like, that's the other thing, yeah.
The show we played on Saturday, we played 6 new songs, and that's the most new songs we've ever played in a set since our first ever gig.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
You just, on your first gig, every song you play is new, and then after that, you just never add 6 new songs.
Right.
So,
unless you've been locked down for 3 months.
Yeah, in the interim, you've put a record out and you feel now's the time, but it's just a weird feeling and not to be able to test anything on audio, test, you know, to get feedback from people.
Yeah, or to get better at those songs.
Or to get
better. We practice a lot, but...
Yeah. Hey, Nick, what questions do you have as a big fan of the best? And I got to say, Nick's the guy that turned Jim and I on to your band to begin with. So
yeah, we're big fans here at the pod. We got a bunch of people who are into it. And, you know, I guess we should just reveal now that Patrick and I are old Flying Nun guys. So I'm guessing I'm guessing you probably get a lot of that type. But consider that a high compliment, because we really love New Zealand music and we love what you guys do. And, you know, when the new album came out, it was pretty thrilling. There was, as you know, you guys had scheduled some dates. I had tickets, I had a pre-order, and then it, you know, as a fan, it just sort of like goes down. But it was exciting to see some of the clips from your show. Was it Power Station? Was that the name of the venue? I mean, it looked like a pretty big venue. Yeah. It's like 1,000 people there or something. I don't know.
That's the size of it. Yeah.
What was it like to play some of those songs? I'm assuming some of those songs you'd never played before an audience like that. Is that correct?
Yeah, well, one, like on the positive side, I'll speak to the positive side because Liz is so good at commenting on the negative side. On the positive side, people knew all the words to Dying to Believe, you know, and we played that song last in the set, which is a bit of a swing because you think, maybe we'll go out with something tried and true, something that we know that people are going to like leave on a high from. But we played that one last I was genuinely shocked by how much that song has been adopted in the short time that it's been out.
Awesome. So, I mean, speaking of that, I mean, why don't you guys talk us through a little bit the process of recording? I mean, I know some, I guess you wrote it on the road or some of it, or, you know, which is fairly common, but I don't think, was it exclusively run, you know, written while you guys were touring, or was some of it done back home, or how did that all sort out?
I'll sometimes write a little on tour, but usually I write in the gaps between tours when we like get home. And Jonathan will be like trying to record some other band in the like 4 weeks that we're there or something like that. Yeah, I'll set myself up just with like a little demo making station, and like I try to make it that I spend as much time doing it as possible, and I try to write as many songs as possible, which is never that many. Uh-huh. as many as I can, because I wanted to have something like 20 or 30 songs or something, options for this album. I didn't quite get to 30. I got to, I don't know.
You're pretty close to 20.
Close to 20. Mm. And mm-hmm. We were playing them and kind of like figuring out which ones were good fits and which songs were duds, and like, yeah, so it's pretty, I think I wanted to like treat it like it was kind of a muscle that I needed to kind of exercise and then do regularly and try and make something good.
So let me ask you, Elizabeth, did you want to write a lot of songs because you didn't want to like, tense up when you knew you had to write a song? You know what I mean? Did you write a bunch of songs so you could sort of get that tension or whatever pressure you put on yourself when you're trying to do something creative out of the way? So if you have 40, you know that like, hey, if I wrote this many, maybe 10 of them are good. I'm very, very interested about the fact that you said you wanted to write a certain amount, you know?
Yeah, I think it's kind of that. I don't want to get stuck. A scary place for me is, I think, trying to spend like the idea of spending a really, really, really long time just like laboring over one song, and then yeah, that's a big pressure on that song to be good.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You got to write a hit.
Yeah, I know. Why so hard to write a hit? When we first started the band, that was kind of my strategy as well. I read like a Ira Glass quote that was something like, when you first start doing something, there's a gap between your taste and your skill, and you have to close that gap just by putting in hours of doing that thing.
Yeah.
And like,
interesting. Yeah.
At the time of starting the band, I really took that to heart, and I wrote a lot and I made a lot of demos. And then like the first gig we did, where we played six songs, we've only kept like one of those, you know, like, wow. Even at that point, it was like, I wanted to get to a point where I was happy with what I was making. And when I felt like I was like, it was good. And I feel like I wanted to kind of get into that mindset again of, it's not wasted time if you write a bad song, because mm-hmm. that song mm-hmm. obviously like needed to be written, and you can be like, okay, well that one's
right.
It's sort of all part of the learning experience, right? And do you ever go back and like mine older songs for just like parts? You know what I mean? Like, hey, there was that song maybe wasn't as good as I wanted it to be, but there was that one thing in there that I can use in another song.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, definitely. It's like a lot of song, I have a lot of fragments. Like I'm sure a lot of songwriters do, like just like voice memos or like little lyrics that are like circled and things like that. And we even did a bit of that with, there's a song in the record called Acrid. Which we played it a little bit live last year, and it's like the consensus is that like the verses were good and working, but the choruses kind of weren't working. And normally I'd probably just like chuck the whole song out, but actually me and Jonathan together kind of managed to like rewrite a new chorus and kind of slot it in and like change the song, and it kind of changed the feeling of the song, and it made it a lot more fun, a little bit less mean. It was kind of like almost a bit resentful, and put it into like a more just fun place.
Like a narrow, always missing, I'm always whistling. And does the whole band, is the whole band involved in that decision? Like, you know, I don't like what I'm playing, and, you know, or is it basically one of the two of you guys being like the final call?
Everyone's involved in that, like, all opinions in the band are valid. We sometimes say that this band's kind of nearly a democracy, but not a democracy. And so, you know, everyone's encouraged to share their view and have a view on it. It's occasionally the case that Tristan and Ben's views are sort of so optimistic in the sense that they're just such sweethearts and such good musicians that they feel that they can fix anything with the right bass,
Yeah, totally. You know?
And yeah. They're almost like sort of unhelpfully optimistic occasionally when you think like, look, like, yeah, I know, Ben, you are a brilliant bass player, but no bass player can make this chorus a banger, you know? Like, it's just not going to happen.
Yeah.
This is on Liz, or perhaps it's on me as a producer at a certain moment or something like that. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, in that exact circumstance, that the example bears out, like, Ben and Tristan were like, nah, this chorus is great. We can make it work. Let's record it again. Let's make it, you know, let's change the feel, change the groove. But in the end, Liz and I kind of ended up rewriting, and I think all agree that it is an improvement.
Yeah. And Nick, you brought this up to me today. I didn't realize about the production role here, right? I mean, you want to ask about that, Nick?
Yeah,
I mean,
one thing you guys posted, or someone posted, I think the artist Toby, I think that I forget his last name, but he did this sort of comic of how you guys took your recording space, which is in your house, I think, correct? And you kind of pulled the walls down and opened it up, or could you just kind of describe, first of all, how you kind of set up this recording space, and then how you went about recording the album?
Toby Morris, he writes for the New Zealand publication The Spinoff, and that's where you can find the comic. So the studio is not in our house. It's on Karangahape Road, which is a road in central Auckland where there's a lot of music venues, and it's kind of like an entertainment hub, and it's a great, great spot. So we have we have 6 meters by 6 meters floor space, and it was divided into 4 small kind of offices. And that's how we made the first album, with as many of us in one of those rooms as possible, and me kind of in the other, which was tough because, you know, it's a small space, but it was like, it worked. But this time around, like Liz insinuated before, we kind of had this break in April of 2019. It was about 4 weeks back here at home. And I don't know, sometimes I just get into a mood, and it was time to take all the walls out. And I have this crazy landlord who just loves it. He's like the biggest fan. And he just lets me do stuff like that, which is great. I don't think he knows yet that I relocated the air conditioning unit in the building as well. But he may have noticed that the noise of it in his office has increased quite a lot.
As homeowners, we appreciate that.
Well, as a renter who believes in renters' rights, I'm pretty keen on just being able to, you know, my place of work, and I'm improving it for my business. So anyway, I'll have a go if you let me.
Yeah.
But yeah, Toby's comment kind of describes us pulling down the walls, which means we can all be together in the same room.
It's a big project.
it felt like a big project. It's just one room, but all the walls out, and there was a false ceiling, so then we had to frame up new walls up to up to the real ceiling.
That's a big project.
Double layers of gym.
All lined all the walls, and then got it. We didn't paint it ourselves, and I am very glad that we got a friend of ours to spray paint the place, because that took like 12 hours, and it would have taken us 12 weeks to paint the place. It was pretty huge. And I think it's probably the most significant impact on the recording of the of Jump Rope Gazers as well, is the fact that we had more space and we kind of prioritized our workflow over any other particular considerations of the recording.
And when you say workflow, what do you mean?
Well, what I wanted was like a lounge room jam kind of vibe.
Okay.
You know, where like the instruments are all kind of pointing at each other and you're just sharing ideas.
Okay, that was part one. Our thanks to Elizabeth and Jonathan for taking time out. It was a bit of a struggle to get this scheduled because of the time difference. I think many of us were confused what day it was and what time it was. So,
That's right.
But it worked out. And, you know, hopefully things will get better around the world and they'll be able to tour other places besides just New Zealand. You know, and I mean, we wish that for all the bands, you know, out there struggling these days, but, you know, at least they are in a good spot and able to play live, you know, unlike a lot of other artists these days. So.
All right. Yeah. And I would certainly recommend people go out. I actually just received my copy today of, Jump Rope Gazers, Park Records. It's a really nice, nicely packaged album. This appears to be, if I could pull it out here, it's some really nice orange vinyl.
Yeah.
Yeah, the packaging is great. The artwork is great. They had, you know, there's an interesting story about how the artwork was done. And I would also recommend their videos are really cool. A lot of those were done during the sort of isolation period using like animations and other things. So, yeah, I mean, you won't be able to see them live probably for some time in the U.S., but the album is out. It's on all the streaming services. Mm-hmm. In fact, it's doing quite well. It got up to number 2 in the album charts in New Zealand this week. It even got to number 9 in the U.K. So that's pretty huge for a small indie band from New Zealand. Now's the time to hop on this if you haven't already, folks.
Yep. So the name of that album again is Jump Rope Gazers. It just came out a couple of weeks ago. On Car Park Records, so check that out. All right, we have part 2 tomorrow, and we got a lot of fun things we'll talk about there. If anyone would like to contact our show, talk about the Beths or anything else, the best way to do that is call and leave a message. The number is US plus 1, 612-440-1984. There you go. Or you can email rock@suburbspod.com or find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram @suburbspod. All right, let's get out of here. Let's move on to tomorrow's part 2. It's Rock in the Suburbs. I'm Jim Lenihan.
I'm Patrick Foster.
And I'm Nick Scalera.
Talk to you guys tomorrow.
Go easy. Now arriving at Ōrākei.